Good afternoon. Well, this afternoon, we are honored to have with us Abbot Brendan Freeman, the abbot of New Mellery Abbey in Teosta, Iowa. I believe he's recently been honored by the diocese with a Distinguished Service Award for something like 27 years as abbot. We are about to receive inspiration, information, etc., that comes out of a long experience of being in monastic community. I believe you entered when you were 20. Is that correct? So, Abbot Brendan has published at the Liturgical Press in 2010 a work called "Come and See: The Monastic Way for Today." So, Abbot Brendan.
I'm not used to speaking to such a large group, so I'm used to speaking to monks in Sunday chapter, sleepy monks. So if any of you starts taking a little nap, it doesn't bother me at all during the conference. And when Dale asked me to speak about 6 or 8 months ago, I said yes and then put it out of my mind. And then I got 6 to 8 months, months to work on this. So I kind of put it back in the back burner, and then about 3 months ago, I got serious about it and started worrying. That's how serious I got. I started to worry. And then about 6 weeks ago, I started working on it, and about 2 weeks ago, I started getting panicky and saying, why did I choose this topic? When he asked me to give the talk, I said, what topic? So I just made up a couple topics. But when you sit down to write about them, friendship is a landmine of difficulties. So I have this particular talk, and the next one, I have some discussion questions that Cindy's going to have on the back table. Maybe after the break we could pick up those questions if you wish. But I'll start with the questions first. And the topic is community and friendship. So the questions come from two different sources that I came across. One is from a conference that our Abbot General gave at our general chapter in 2005. And it was a long conference. He split it into two parts. The second set of questions comes from Father Terence Cardon's review of the book, A Pilgrim in a Pilgrim Church. It's the autobiography of Rembrandt Wieklin. And he had that review in Chirunga, which is the Australian Benedictine Review, the ABA of Australia. So the conference of Don Bernardo, our farmer abbot general, we have a new one now from Ireland, Eamon Fitzgerald, from our mother house in Mount Melry, by the way. Anyway, the conference from Don Bernardo is entitled An Anthropology of Desire at the Service of Formation. And we'll begin with that paper. He says, Bernardo says, what prompted him to write this paper was the departure of 5 or 6 young, solemnly professed monks in a 2-year period. See, he handles all the dispensations for our order. We have about 170 monasteries around the world. So for 5 or 6 young, solemnly professed in a 2-year period, which is a little bit high, I think, but what prompted him to write the paper was the fact that these guys left, or asked to leave. In almost every case, he says, there were two common factors, namely the discovery of human love embodied in a particular woman and the total relativity of everything the man previously lived. So the total relativity of what went before when they came across this human love. It would seem, he says, that the discovery of human love had converted his former search for God into something unreal. Now, I think we've all experienced people who have left the monasteries and their religious life for the same reason. He then raises the question, what kind of formation did we offer these young men? What human foundation was the spiritual skyscraper built on? What type of anthropology was explored in their formation process? Are we really convinced that grace builds on nature? Do we perhaps repress what is instinctive in us so as to favor the rational? Do we give priority to the spirit to the detriment of the body? Finally, are we fostering split personalities even though we say the opposite? So those are some of the questions he raises. We won't look at all those, but a few of them. Now, for Terence's review of Rembrandt's book, this is just a little paragraph from the review. He says, Rembrandt's conclusion is that his education as a Benedictine monk and a priest was utterly inadequate for anyone trying to negotiate public life in the 20th century. In his recollection, questions of psychosexual issues were simply avoided by all his teachers and superiors. This was not because these mentors were generally inept. In fact, he gives his formation at St. Vincent's very high marks. But the whole church, indeed the whole society, was utterly unable and unwilling to deal with effective life as it is experienced by most people. I think Rembrandt entered in the middle 40s, late 40s. So I entered in 58, so it's not that distant. Anyway, like many clergymen, Terence says, Weakland was a stellar student, but he lived primarily in his head. His knowledge of his emotions was virtually nil, and so when he fell in love, he was simply bowled over. As for Rembrandt, he talks very frankly about what it was like to be a famous abbot primate and archbishop. It may have been glamorous and exciting to be forever in the limelight, but it was also extremely lonely. That theme comes up again and again in the book, Terence says. By and large, he had nobody with whom to share his burdens. He has no spouse for support and consolation. He did engage in serious study in Lectio Divina, yet he insists that this is still not enough. I've heard this statement many, many times in the last, I'll be abbot 30 years next year, and after retire, I'll be 75 a year from now. But anyway, someone to share your burden with. People get into big trouble when they keep things too stuffed in their life, and no one to share with. That's a big, I'm talking about friendship as basically sharing. So, Terence concludes, the point is that all of us were and still are extremely ignorant and naive about many aspects of human sexual response. There are many interesting questions raised by these two examples, the paper from Bernardo and this little review of Rembrandt. Questions from Bernardo's paper that I picked out. He says the discovery of human love had converted the monk's former search for God into something unreal. Total relativity is given to everything the man had previously lived. Why do you think this was the case? Have you ever known someone to leave after solemn vows? What were the dynamics in that decision? Second question. He said, are we fostering split personalities in our formation programs? How would you describe a split personality? And three, was friendship studied in your formation program? Sister Genevieve mentioned this morning something I was very familiar with. No friendships during, 1950, till after the council for our community anyway. And there was the savior was a junior director who came back from Rome with a degree in psychology, and he studied Carl Rogers, if you remember him. He was very popular in the 60s. Anyway, some questions, as from Don Bernardo's paper, some questions from Terence Cardon's review. He says Rembert gives high marks to his formators at St. Vincent's, but he does admit that it was utterly inadequate for anyone trying to negotiate public life in the 20th century. Do you think this is still true of our formation programs? What is missing? And secondly, speaking of the time he was in formation, Terence says, the whole church, indeed the whole society, was utterly unable and unwilling to deal with affective life as it is experienced in most people. Do you think this is still true? What is the affective life? And three, he says he did engage in serious study and Lectio Divina, yet he insists it was not enough. What was missing? Does monastic life allow for close personal friends? Do we still live primarily in our heads? So these are several, there's other questions, but these are the ones I sort of isolated out of those two sources. So with these questions, and maybe a discussion later on, we can try to give a context of this whole issue of friendship and its importance in our monastic life and its relationship to contemplation. In the examples I used above about young monks who left and a famous man who has done so much good for the church, I admire him tremendously, by the way. I'm just singling him out as an example that we can all learn from. So I'm not pointing a finger and saying how wrong any of these people were. We've all known good people who've left. All I want to do is underline the importance of the place of friendship in our life. I think loneliness plays a key role here. When you're lonely, your heart aches for companionship. I think we can say loneliness comes from the absence of something important that every human being needs. So now let's take a look at the absence that is in everyone's heart. Someone said a poem begins with an ache in the heart. And I think the same can be said about friendship. Can any of us remember when our affections were awakened? Some person came into our lives and everything changed? There could have been an ache in your heart, but you were not aware of it until meeting a friend who revealed it. I remember reading about the French philosopher Maurice Blondel, who married late in life, and he said he could not imagine or believe that someone loved him. Just staggered him. And I think there's many of us like that. It's not an uncommon experience. But when it happens, there is a sea change, and your life takes on a texture and a brilliance, and your thoughts are hyper-focused on your friend. And lo and behold, you become vulnerable and subject to a lot of feelings that are not much fun, such as jealousy. Your antenna is for jealousy is on high alert. I was reading an article there recently in Christian Century about there's a class at Boston University on dating. And it seems like dating has fallen on the wayside as a social event for younger people. Kids hang around in crowds now. One of the assignments for this class is that each student has to have a traditional date before the end of the semester. And it's very hard. They're very reluctant to try it. I remember that in high school. The reason they're reluctant is dating makes you feel vulnerable. And having a date for an evening, the author said, a woman professor teaches us, having a date for the evening means someone will focus on you for some time, and this can be uncomfortable. So dating is one thing, but effective relationships and community are just as interesting in monastic life. Our affections trigger a lot of other movements in our soul. There are instinctual movements we cannot always control. There are emotions, as when your heart goes out to someone, it can run away with you. There are intellectual judgments and moral judgments. Interpersonal relationships are the ecstasy and anxiety and agony of community life. So Saint Aelred, who wrote extensively on friendship from a medieval perspective, said that physical attraction is one of the most dangerous types of friendship. And yet he did not condemn it. He put it on a scale. It's pretty low on the scale, but he acknowledged it as there. I think it is dangerous, these physical attractions, because it can masquerade as the whole picture. And we know that's not the whole picture of friendship. It might not even be part of the picture, because you have deep friendships without having any type of physical attraction. And you can have a strong emotional bonding, and that's still not the whole picture. You hate to see two people make a commitment on a flimsy foundation. And I think that happens in religious life because they take off for flimsy reasons sometimes. When a solemnly professed comes and says he or she is thinking of leaving, you know they've already made up their mind. They're going to do it, leave. It's nearly impossible to get them to look at the bigger picture and situate what they're going through into the context of their whole religious life. The new relationship is just too strong to be modified by their religious experience. As the Abbot General said, what went before doesn't seem to make any sense to them. It's trying to reason with an emotion, and that doesn't always work. So what I would like to do is sort of setting the program, the examples. So I'd like to do is try to situate friendship into the whole scheme of our monastic life. Unlike married people, it's not the whole of our life, but a wonderful part. What is the whole, then, that this is a part of? I'd like to attempt an answer. Genevieve was great this morning. The questions are better than the answers, so I might leave you with a lot of questions. I'd like to begin trying to answer this from an opening sentence of a homily of St. Bernard. He came into the chapter room at the monastery of Clairvaux one morning and began his chapter talk by saying, "Today, the text we are to study is the book of our own experience." Then he goes on, "You must therefore turn your attention inward. Each one must take note of his or her particular awareness of the things I'm about to discuss." I think that's a beautiful way to start the homily or the conference. He was discussing a line from the Song of Songs, "Let him kiss me with the kiss of his mouth," which I find creepy in a way, you know, but it's a very sacred text, but at the same time. We had a Dutch retreat master one time. He was at our Generalate in Rome, Vincent Hermans. This was like 1964. I found the notes the other day. He gave us the notes of his talk. And he had his Dutch accent, and he used this phrase from St. Bernard quite a bit during the retreat. But it came out like this, let him kiss me with the kiss of the mouse. And that's all I remember of that retreat. It kept coming up and up, and we're just trying to be very polite, but afterwards, oh my gosh. You know, it's really hard to remember anything from retreats. But that line from 64 is just in my mind. But I love the image. Study the book of your own experience. Our experiences form the book of our life. We need to learn to read it and find out who we are. To do this, Bernard says, we must turn inward and take note of your particular awareness. Your awareness is not mine, possibly, but it's yours. And that's all each of us has, our own experience. How you read and interpret it is important. I think awareness is a key word in the definition of contemplation. Here's how Merton defines the word contemplation. He says, contemplation is the sudden gift of awareness, an awakening to the real, capital R, awakening to the real within the real, a vivid awareness of infinite being at the root of our limited being, an awareness of our contingent reality as a received gift from God. I love that definition. We awaken to something that has been with us all the time, but somehow we missed it. Something like, I think, Satori, that enlightenment that the Buddhist monks talk about. A revelation of the real, a revelation of our contingent reality, of infinite being at the root of our limited being. In other words, we are not complete. We are contingent, limited, yet in these diminishments, if you call them that, is our fulfillment. You're not going to realize the fullness of infinite being unless you realize your limited being. Bernardo says, the mystical experience concerns the direct apprehension of one's interiority, the experience of a deep presence and communion from within one's depths. So the sense that you're not alone in the depths of your being, there's another there. And that's where real friendship begins. To experience a deep presence in the emptiness of our life is a type of contemplation. So to see what is already there, the famous book by De Caussade, The Abandonment to Divine Providence, is full of that type of thinking. He says, the written word of God is full of mysteries, and equally so is his word expressed in world events. I think that's fabulous. World events. We read about them all the time. But he says the word of God is hidden in world events just as it's hidden in Scripture. These two books, he goes on, are truly sealed, and it can be said of both of them, the letter brings death. And I think that's what happens with the literalist, you know, and sometimes the fundamentalist. Further on, De Caussade says, God speaks to every individual by what happens to them moment by moment. So that's your experience, what's going on in your life moment by moment, day by day, week by week. God is speaking to you. So returning now to the book of our experience, I want to highlight a universal experience that each one of us has had, or better, really, is now having. One we're so used to living with that we barely notice it. And here is what I'm talking about in a nutshell. And this is a quote from Bernardo again. When we speak of desire, we are referring to the movement towards some absent thing or person we perceive as good and attractive. More specifically, desire implies a feeling of absence due to lack of satisfaction with what's available. So the reality of absence is extremely important in our life, and it's an experience we all have. We experience the absence of God. That's just one of the primary experiences of our life. It is the wellspring of desire. It's the driving force behind much of our actions. If we could line up a dynamic, it would look something like this: absence, desire, presence, satisfaction. So I'd like to interject some select verses of a poem by, if I can pronounce it, Thaddeus Rozwich, entitled A Sketch for a Modern Love Poem. I hate people that read poems to you because it's really hard on the fly to pick up verses of a poem, but here I am. The poem begins, A Sketch for a Modern Love Poem. And yet whiteness can best be described by grayness. A bird by a stone. The most palpable description of bread is that of hunger. A transparent source-like description of water is thirst, of ash, of desert. Absence of flesh is a description of love in a modern love poem. So there's all kinds of ways to interpret what this poem means, but I like the idea of trying to get behind reality by describing the absence of something, to bring out more vividly its presence. The most palpable description of bread is hunger. You can almost feel the meaning. When you have no bread, you're hungry. And the less bread you have, the more hungry you become until you crave bread. Then you really know from inside your belly the worth and meaning of bread. Thirst does the same for water. The poet goes on, "The best way to describe a bird is to look at a stone. The contrast with flight and lightness and movement in a bird is absent from the immovability of a stone, its heaviness and fixity. A stone never moves on its own. We can appreciate a bird by contrasting it with a stone. A stone is the absence of everything that the bird possesses." If we can identify the basic absence in our life, we will have the best description of a human being. To do this, I want to quote from the compendium of the Catechism of the Catholic Church. The quote is, "God, by creating us in his own image, has written in the human heart the desire to see God, even though this desire is often ignored. God does not cease to draw us to himself so that we may live and find in God that fullness of truth and happiness which we are constantly looking for. That is why a human being by nature and vocation is a religious being, capable of entering into communion with God. This intimate, vital bond with God confers on the human our fundamental dignity." So we're created in the image of God, and we're forever looking for that image. So we have written in our heart, that is, in the deepest level of our being, a desire to see God. And the word heart, of course, is symbol for the most important part of our spirit. What the physical heart is to the body, the spiritual heart is to our spiritual life. There's no life without the heart and the body. So in the realm of the spirit, the word heart designates secret source whence proceeds our deepest spiritual life. There's another interesting quote from Merton. It's what Merton calls our true self, our heart, our spirit. Merton says, "Since the inmost I, the self, is the perfect image of God, then when the I awakens," there's that word awaken again, "it finds within itself the presence of the one whose image it is. And by a paradox beyond the human expression, God and the soul seem to have but one simple I, our heart." So traditionally, the monastic life has been called a redire ad cor, a return to your heart, to find your heart, and the search for our heart, the center where God is present and where we're united to God all the time. When we have found our heart, or more correctly, when our heart has been revealed to us, we have arrived at what the Eastern monks identify as continual prayer. Here's how Callistus Ware describes it, quoting an Orthodox writer. The quote, "You yourself must be silent. Let the prayer speak. To achieve silence, this is of all things the hardest and the most decisive in the art of prayer. Silence is not merely negative, a pause between words, a temporary cessation of speech, but properly understood, it is highly positive, an attitude of attentive alertness, of vigilance, and above all, of listening. The hesychast, the one who attains Hezekiah, inward stillness, or silence, or purity of heart, I read, is par excellence the one who listens. He listens to the voice of prayer in his own heart, and he understands that this voice is not his own, but that of another speaking within him. Just that idea that you're not alone. There's another at the depths of your being. So speaking within us. We pass from prayer expressed in words to prayer of silence. from strenuous self-acting prayer, which is what we're always at in a way, from prayer, from that type of prayer, to the prayer of Christ in me. And that's continual prayer, because Christ is always praying within us to the Father, and we're baptized into Christ. We receive Christ. So according to this way of thinking, prayer is the disclosure of our true self. In our deepest being, in the center of our heart, we are praying all the time, even as we sleep. Our heart is watching and waiting and praying with Christ present in us. Karl Rahner says it like this: what is most intrinsic to the human being is God's self-communication. God's self-communication to each one of us is attested to in Scripture, the teaching of the Church, and is expressed in such language as, you are a child of God, you are a temple of the Holy Spirit, you participate in the divine nature, and that you will see God face to face. What you will one day possess fully and completely, we already are now, although in a hidden way. And that's the problem, in a way. It's hidden from us. It's absent, but it is present. So hidden is a key word, because in our deepest being, we are always united to God, but are seldom, if ever, aware of it. I believe Meister Eckhart, who said, there's nothing so unknown to the soul as herself. We're a mystery to ourselves. That's what Augustine says, God is a mystery, and since we have part of God in us, we too are a mystery. Contemplation happens when we become even slightly aware of our hidden self, our soul, our being in God. But right now, we live in a cloud of unknowing and a land, says St. Bernard, of unlikeness, a vast, empty desert. So if you understand it correctly, it's a beautiful place to be, this desert. The metaphor of the desert has always been important in monastic life. The vast emptiness of the desert is a mirror of our soul. Rahner says, the emptiness of the creature exists because the fullness of God created this emptiness in order to communicate himself to it. Contemplation is important here because contemplation is a unitive experience. You can contemplate the emptiness of your own life, your own inner being, and then realize that this is only part of the picture. Your emptiness only exists so God can fill it. The book of our experience has many chapters on emptiness, absence, incompleteness, contingency, and these are the seedbeds for a contemplative life. Experience like this does not mean something is wrong with us. All we are doing is experiencing our nature before God. They really are graces that lead to prayer. St. Augustine said in his Confessions, or about confess, he says, he confesses before God in silence, and yet not in silence. He says, my voice is silent, but my heart cries out. It's a beautiful way to express a life of prayer. It's a beautiful, you might be silent, but your heart is crying out. Might be crying out because of the emptiness in your life, which is put there by God. And there's a beautiful meditation, you might be familiar with it, from St. Anselm. Just listen to pathos, to the affectivity in this prayer. It begins, Lord, my God, teach my heart where and how to seek you, where and how to find you. Lord, if you are not here, where shall I look for you in your absence? Yet if you are everywhere, why do I not see you when you are present? Lord, you are my God and you are my Lord, and I have never seen you. You have made me and remade me, and you have given me all the good things I possess, and still I do not know you. I was made in order to see you, and I have not yet done that for which I was made. That's a powerful sentence. I was made to see God, and I've yet to do it. And I'm 74 years old. Anyway, I was made in order to see you, and I have not yet done that for which I was made. Look upon us. Restore yourself to us. Teach us to seek you. And when seeking you, show yourself to me, for I cannot seek you unless you teach me. So the experience of the absence of God is probably the most real experience of God we have. If it causes you pain, then that means you somehow have seen God. Otherwise, you wouldn't desire it, you wouldn't be pained by not seeing him. St. Benedict makes sure the novice is truly seeking God. In other words, he knows the absence in his or her life, the emptiness, the incompleteness, and has identified it as a fundamental part of his or her humanity, and realizes that only God can complete us. The basic truth about ourselves is that our own reality is not in our hand. We always experience ourselves as having our origin in another. So we know ourselves through that which we are not. That poem, that which you're not. You know yourself by that which you are not. So let's return to Don Bernardo's study for a minute, get more into friendship. To truly seek God and be aware of his absence leads to a desire for God, but does not mean other desires are forgotten. I'm trying to put friendship in the context of these broader desires. I think Bernardo means, when he asked the question, what kind of anthropology was implicit in our formation programs? What human foundation was the spiritual skyscraper built on? So I'm attempting to set friendship in a larger context of a basic human trait, which we could poetically call the mother house of all our other desires. It's the mother lode of our absence of God. And I'm talking about our experience of absence and its resulting desire to fill the void. Yet this is very paradoxical. Contemplation grows, as it were, in the garden of emptiness and void. I'm choosing that image deliberately. A garden is usually an image of fullness and life. But I hope to be able to show that that emptiness can also be a type of garden which produces good fruit, fruit that will last for eternity. The monastic life is a type of school and education in the formation of our heart that helps us understand and even cherish the void, the space, the special place that no one can fill but God. We'll come back to this later. Right now, let's look at friendship. This is not an easy topic to situate in a monastic setting, at least not for us older monastics. Remember how Terence said Rimbert had no one to share his burden with, and he was lonely even in the midst of great and important activity. When I was in formation, and I'm sure it was the same for Rimbert, friendship was not deemed important. Really, it was only after Vatican II in my own community that it began to flower. I was reading a section of Terence Cardon's commentary on chapter 2 of the Rule, where he gives two models of authority in ancient monastic life. One where the leader comes out of the community. The community sort of gives life to that person who's going to be their leader. I think active apostolic sisters have that sort of model. And the other, where the elder is considered a wise senior, the Abba, or the mother, the Amma, I guess they call it. That wise senior has disciples. That's the second model. Now, Terence says Benedict used this second model in the Rule, especially in chapter 2. He modifies it in chapter 64. But the elder-disciple model, in that model, interpersonal relationships between community members was not important. The primary relationship was between the Abba and the disciple. Terence explains it like this. no amount of these master-disciple units made a true community, since there was no intrinsic horizontal bond between the disciples. Now, when I entered a monastery in 1958, we were following a modified form of this vertical relationship model. We really did not have an elder as such to follow, not like you read about in the Desert Fathers anyway. I often wondered about that. There was nobody in my monastery was like that. So what we did, actually, I think maybe you might have done the same thing. We made the rule the elder, and the observances and the regulations, they became our mentors. Sort of our masters, in a sense. So among us, there was little real contact. We did not know each other's last name or anything about each other's background. And then thank God for Vatican II. By the way, I was reading something the other day. Most young people had never heard of Vatican II, and not even the Vietnam War, all the things that we grew up with and are vital to us. And this teacher asked, I think it was sophomores in high school, what was Vatican II? And one kid who never raised his hand, raised his hands, really, or his hand, enthusiastically, and she was surprised. She says, Billy, what is it? And he said, it's the summer home of the Pope. Which makes sense, you know, Vatican II. So the monastic day is said to be a balance between prayer, work, and Lectio Divina, and study. And this takes up a great portion of our time. There's no set time for friendship, which I suppose is the way it should be, because friendship can be threaded through our whole day. Our monastic day, even our life as monastics, can seem to be very programmed, but we do have a lot of choices to make. Discernment is a great monastic virtue. Where the Spirit is leading us, where is our heart leading us? Where are our passions leading us? We have a lot of forces and drives, emotions competing with our will and our intellect. You may know what you should do, but then do just the opposite. But don't worry, St. Paul did the same thing in Romans 7. I think it's very important to know what is motivating us. And this brings us once again into the world of desire. Bernardo says, we have to be grounded in our personal life. And this happens when we recognize our structural lack of completeness. To accept absence with the existential solitude it implies, which is so characteristic of the human condition, is an indispensable requisite for establishing relationships with others. In fact, it is only when we recognize that we are beings in need that another person, precisely as other, can become a companion on our journey. So that's the foundation of relationships. We are not everything to anybody, and nobody can be everything to us. This knowledge, this discernment, is a necessary condition for success in any marriage, any friendship, any group of brothers or sisters, any community, anything working toward unity. There will always be an essential distance, separation, and distinctive differences. Everything is both presence and absence, even the most intimate forms of communion. There's a very interesting couple sentences in Wuthering Heights where Catherine tells Nellie she loves Heathcliff. I found this in a book on Eros and Agape, I think it is. Eros and Allegory by Dennis Turner. It's on the Song of Songs and various fathers who comment on the song. It's in a wonderful book. Anyway, Nellie says she loves Heathcliff. Not because he's handsome, Nellie, but because he is more myself than I am. Whatever our souls are made of, says Catherine, his and mine are the same. She goes on, surely you and everybody have a notion that there is or should be an existence beyond him. Nellie, I am Heathcliff. He is always on my mind, not as a pleasure any more than I am always a pleasure to myself, but as my own being. So don't talk of our separation again. It is impossible. Now here we have, I think, a wonderful description of fusion, which eventually will destroy a relationship. We cannot give away the center of our being to anyone less worthy than God. We are made for God, and only in God will we find rest for our unlimited desires. Discernment is critical because it is the means we use to become aware or identify what is moving us, what from outside ourselves has stoked the fires of desire that are smoldering underneath our conscious awareness. Self-knowledge is one of the first steps in a spiritual life. What is motivating us? Is it really going to satisfy our longing, or is it just a temptation, a blind alley, beckoning us into the dark, which we mistook as light? This is important because our monasteries today are not as protected from cultural influences as they were say 10 years ago, with what cell phones, iPads, high-speed internet, to name a few of the things that seep in through the cracks in the cloister. This came up this morning in the question of the internet. Not that these things are bad. We've gone all over the place with this in our monastery. First, we were taking people, and they'd bring pickup trucks of stuff with them, and all had their own computer, and then we figured, well, what if a guy doesn't have a computer and he comes, the other guy does? So we banned computers, personal computers, and then all kinds of trouble with internet. So we banned internet for the first 2 years in a novitiate. That's where we are right now. Anyway, not that these things are bad, but the monastic practice of guarding your heart is very important. Since the days when Evagrius taught us to guard our thoughts, a lot has happened. The desert has become a city, as one of the ancients said. Cardiognosis, knowledge of one's own heart, is still very important in monastic life. Values that our society esteem and drive our culture are so different than monastic values. Individualism and materialism are the twin pillars that support the philosophies of John Locke and Thomas Hobbes. Locke taught the value of unlimited acquisition of wealth. This, in turn, requires the creation of a consumer-oriented community or economy. You've all been influenced by this type of thinking, by this economy. It is the air we breathe. Consumption is stimulated by marketing, and the acquisition of wealth unleashes desire. Now, the twist here, this is kind of important for us, I think, is that all marketing is the reduction of a big desire to a small desire. Marketers are very intelligent. They honed in on one of our basic needs. We long for beauty, love, friendship, and wisdom, to name a few of the big desires that are in our life. It's the job of advertising to convince you that what you really want. The way you will attain these big values is by purchasing the product they're selling you. The big desires, such as love and friendship, cannot be acquired by anything you can buy. So we're trained by marketing and advertising to substitute little desires for the big desires, the ones they're selling. What is insidious about this is that they have identified one of our basic human traits, absence and desire, and twisted them to their advantage. It is a substitution unworthy of us, yet it is hard to withstand. Our culture, without trying, leads us to turn away from community to the individual, to deny our longing and attempt to fill our emptiness by purchasing more and more products. Our emptiness can only be met by something worthy of us. Rahner says, God has created us with this void in our hearts, and only God can fill it. all our relationships, marriage, friendship, companionship, are based on desire. But the proper ordering of our desire is crucial. Medieval monks were very taken with the proper ordering of things. Benedict was too, the proper order in the community. Desire is a basic structure of our makeup before being differentiated into various types of desire. Monastic formation means finding the vital center of our being, finding our heart, in biblical terms, where our desire for God has its source and fulfillment. The primordial desire underlies all our affectivity and our willpower. So again, the primordial desire, which structures our human existence, generates the whole series of aspirations, anxieties, longing, drives and appetites, wishes, ambitions, fancies, and even whims, which take shape with the passage of time in the life of each one of us. This gives rise to a most complex assortment of desires closely related to the ups and downs of our personal story. The problem is not to lose the basic desire, the basic emptiness and absence. Acedia, a particular nasty vice for monastic life, is so deadly to us because it blows out the fire of desire. It deadens our life. It reduces us to indifference and I don't care about anything attitude. Someone suffering from acedia could probably not even hear the pathos in St. Anselm's prayer. There's a sweet, painful longing in his words, words that are very easy to make our own. St. Bernard wrote something like 85 or 87 sermons on the Song of Songs, and they're filled with the same pathos, words like to sigh, to crave, thirst, cry out, to faint away, to be distressed. These describe someone consumed with longing and desire for love, for fulfillment and completion. If you ever want to gauge where you are in the spiritual life, ask yourself, do you still desire God with all your heart? This does not mean you have found God or experienced God or feel anything. It only means you feel the absence of God in such a way that down deep you know it is a mysterious experience of God. To have an intense longing for God means you in some sense have found God. Only a couple more pages. It's getting late. I was worried I only have 10 minutes. That I could only speak for 10 minutes. That's about my chapter talk length. So I might have gone overboard. I don't know. The etymology of the word desire comes from the Latin desidere, meaning a privative, a way, de, or lack, and the noun sidus, star, a heavenly body. We all have a star in our life, something or someone we hold dear. Desire means we do not possess it fully. Humans are not fully satisfied with life, but that's okay. St. Bernard says, all rational beings by their very nature are continually longing for what seems better, and they are not satisfied as long as they do not have what they consider to be better. So I mentioned earlier that the proper ordering of desire is important. The proper order was important to Benedict, and the ordering of love was a great theme of the monastic fathers. We speak of three types of desire that make the world go around. Spiritual desire, whose goal is communion with God, which is what Benedict's looking for in the novice. Affective desire, whose goal is interpersonal friendship. And biological desire, which includes sexual appetites. Bernardus has this: sex without affection is depersonalized. With affection, we have intimacy. Yet you can have intimacy without biological desire. Affection is the home of friendship, and as long as it stays where it belongs, it is healthy. But if it wanders, it becomes unhealthy in two ways. First, it can try to usurp the place of God, which happens, And this is a biblical sense of idolatry, putting a person in the place of God. Or secondly, it can be reduced to sex, which without affection fosters relations between two bodies, but not between two persons. Another word for affection here could be eros. Eros is a type of love. It's not totally the disinterested love of agape, but it's a very important form of love. So let me end with the most beautiful description of friendship that I know of, and it's from St. Aelred's book, The Mirror of Charity. And Aelred lived about 1,000 years ago. But it attested universality of friendship, timelessness of friendship. Now, I don't think anybody's experienced fully what these words have, but even if you experience a phrase or a sentence, I think you're a blessed person. He says, "The sweetness of God that we taste in this life is given us not so much for enjoyment as for consolation and encouragement for our weakness. That is why it is such a great joy to have the consolation of someone's affection, someone to whom one is deeply united by the bond of love, someone in whom our weary spirit may find rest and to whom we may pour out our souls, someone whose conversation is as sweet as a song and the tedium of our daily life. He or she must be someone whose soul will be to us a refuge to creep into when the world is altogether too much for us. Someone to whom we can confide all our thoughts. He or she will weep with us when we're troubled and rejoice with us when we are happy and will always be there to consult when we are in doubt. And we will be so deeply bound to her in our hearts that even when she is far away, we shall find her together with us in spirit, together and alone. The world will fall asleep all around you. You will find, and your soul will rest, embraced in absolute peace. In this life on earth, we can love a few people in this way, with heart and mind together, for they are more bound to us by the ties of love than on the other." So we'll take a break and see if there's any questions or anything. Thank you.
John, of course, is building his house in the town. That was the saddest thing. Oh. And Mickey couldn't stay in the house. It was just too old. Well, they used to come every year with their kids. We watched the kids grow up. I think they're all married now.
Who's the girl married?
Jessica.
Jessica.
She's married. She has a child.
Okay.
I think she does. I know Jonathan.
Yeah.
I think he has. Oh, yeah. Is he still married?
Uh-huh. Well, as far as I know, I can't. I was just with Mickey at a conference with Richard Gelardis.
Who?
Richard Gelardis from Boston College, Boston University.
Oh, yeah. I'm not familiar. I should.
He does a lot with Vatican II stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So,
well,
anyway.
They're going back on Vatican II, so watch out.
I think last week, because I have no memory of it.
Oh, that's right.
It's interesting, too, because you talked about the need for friendship.
Uh-huh.
And Vatican II is a positive one. One thing that we struggle with in the kids' community is I just want to be friends with my sisters.
You know, there's
a... You're getting better.
Oh, good, good. How long have you been in the country?
6 years.
Oh, 6 years. Yeah, see, that's it's a whole learning experience for the older people. We were lucky, the juniors, we got the experience.
Yeah.
But as Sister said this morning, you know, for a pair to go for a walk together was quite shocking. You know? But after that, it was just awesome. We were so impressed. But when it happened, well, they were sort of raised with that model that Terrence Cardon mentioned, the elder disciple. And the horizontal doesn't make much difference. Who's Terrence?
Woman who just walked up here, she's also my aunt.
Oh, good. Yeah, good for you. Hi, Father.
Joseph.
Yes.
I just came there to you last night. Thank you.
Break is over. Pardon me? Yeah, well, that, I can't sing, so... Okay, you go.
Alleluia, alleluia, alleluia.
There.
Alleluia. Well, that was good. I was talking to one of the sisters at the break, and she reminded me, for some reason I brought up, that I was almost joined the Benedictines at the Conception Abbey. We have an archbishop, Jerome Hannes, is from Conception Abbey, and we had a Benedictine archbishop before him, Daniel Cusera. Anyway, I went to Conception, and I was 19 years old, and I was going to join the community. I have two uncles in that community. One from my mother's side and one from my father's side. Father Dominic Labin was the one that was well known. He was chaplain at Nauvoo, and he was chaplain at Sacred Heart, and he was chaplain at Clyde and Tucson and Kansas City for all the sisters. And I don't think he was a good chaplain, because he didn't like Vatican II, for one thing. Maybe that's why they moved around so much. But anyway, we can just... go right into the question, whatever questions you have. I had some in the paper, but it doesn't, you know. Yes, sister. Is Cindy got there? She is.
I think something we probably agree has been very much lacking in our church and in our society is an emphasis on healthy sexual expression. And so when we say we don't have good, you know, maybe good programs in our formation around intimacy and sexuality, we're products of our culture and of our church. I would consider you very wise in a lot of things, having been an abbot and seen a lot of humanity. And you probably meet with other abbots, and you have some of the same issues that we have in our community. If you believe we maybe haven't done a good job in formation around intimacy and sexuality, what is it that you would like to put into your program that isn't there, that could help us turn this around a little bit and bring more health and wholeness to our candidates and our members?
Well, if I had the answer to that question, but it just sparked something in my mind when you said, thank you, sister, for that question. I'll remind you of something that happened with us right after the council. I mentioned the priest that came back from Rome and had studied Carl Rogers. Well, he was our junior director, and I think we had something like 25 juniors at the time, maybe 20 novices, and we had 160 in the community in 1960. We're 31 right now. But anyway, the junior director would give a talk every Sunday to the juniors like at 2 in the Sunday afternoon. Well, he would be something like this, a classroom sort of approach. Well, he sat us in a circle and scared the heck out of us, because... we had to look at each other for one thing. And then he said, let's just go around and each one tell your story. So that took close to 3 or 4 months. We'd maybe get through 2 or 3 every Sunday. And your turn was coming, and you were very nervous about it. But it bound us together. You could talk for however long you wanted to, who you were, where you came from, what you were thinking about, and what books you're reading. And I would think if I look at our juniors now, and they don't seem to relate with each other real well. We you know, these were the years when sensitivity sessions were going on and all that type of thing. The St. Louis Workshop, if you ever heard of that, and things like that. And that was kind of overboard. But the idea of sharing your life with someone at a not just a incidental level of, you know, sports or whatever, but who you are really is good for, I think intimacy is sharing your thoughts, your life, your burdens, what bothers you with someone else. And I'd like to see our juniors have that same experience that we had, because after that, friendship sort of flowered among our group, and we were the first group to do that in the monastery. There's seniors above me that have never had that experience, and some great friendships were born in that time, and a lot of my closest friends left, but I still have close friends in the community. But something like that might be helpful. We just had at a workshop in our community. We, since there's not a lot of juniors anymore in our monasteries, we have a junior program every year for all the monasteries. We have 17 monasteries in the States, and we have a two-week junior program. And the highlight of it is this juniors get to talk to each other, you know, over meals and whatever, and they have classes. Well, the classes this, let's see, it was just about a month ago, were, forget the title, it was something like psychosexual development. And they brought in Kevin McClone, I think his name is. He teaches a class at CTU, and he's the inheritor of the Jesuit that started Human Development magazine, Gills, James Gills. And I think James Gills had a sexuality program of some kind also. But he came in and gave a week's course on this psychosexual development in human life. And then Father Mark Scott, the retired abbot of Ava, gave a week's presentation on that. Of course, it was all closed to us, so I don't know what they talked about. But they seemed to like it. But that's the first time I remember that they directly addressed the issue. So it's really, it's not an easy issue to talk about. But I think intimacy is really, like it said, Rembrandt didn't have anyone to share his burdens with. Now, that's a type of intimacy. I have a friend in another monastery, the abbot of another monastery. When we get together for meetings, we can tell each other anything without embarrassment. And if you know you have a friend you can trust, something like that, to me, that's a wonderful, wonderful gift. So I don't know if that answers your question, but so, yes.
I think that the last thing you said is really important, that you have a friend. I think one of the things that I remember from my early years in community was that we had the model of a good friendship in the community. And I think that goes a long way to making it legitimate, mm-hmm. and, you know, providing a way for the younger members of the community, if they see two older sisters who are good friends, but they are spiritual women, and they are lovers of the community and will do anything for anybody, but they are support for each other. What can be a better evidence than that?
Oh, sure, sure. Yeah. I think that's the flowering of monastic life in a way. But as Sister Genevieve mentioned this morning, it can be very divisive in community if it gets exclusive. And I've seen that happen many times. And bringing up this whole topic is difficult because maybe you don't have a friend, and then you feel the lack of it, you know? It's just something that happens. It's not something you can program, I don't think. But I was trying to point out that the basic friendship is the with the Lord, and after that you can fit everything else into that. And I think when, not everybody left, but when people leave because they find somebody, they forget this other primary relationship. it seemed didn't work or something. I don't know.
Well, I believe that our ultimate dependence has to be on God, but friends, as Aylred would say, St. Aylred would say, help us along that path. I don't see in our community or in other communities that when we're looking at candidates that we see pick people that have a capacity already for friendship. I think that's a very important thing. If someone's 21 years old and doesn't have the capacity for friendship, I think to join a community to get friends may be the wrong reason. But we need to be looking at in their development, and when we give them a psychological test, and their history, have they had a history of being able to keep friends and to have friends and have healthy friends? And I think that goes a long way in then with the community for a flowering of friendship. But I think that's a quality that I would look for, that I look for in candidates. And if they're loners and can't make friendships before they come, they probably won't do it afterward.
Yeah, that's good observation, Father. You know, I think that we used to have a question in our questionnaire, do you play sports? And the idea behind that is team, working with someone else as a team, you know? And the same could be said with friendship before you entered. But I think in formation, I think the first 2 years in a novitiate, people really are focusing on their search for God, not the guy next to them or the sister next to them. So you have to bracket that for a little while, it seems to me. And then later on, if you have, as Father said, an experience of being able to be friends, that will come out. But the search, the solitary search for God is important. And you're not there just to be friends. You're there to search for God and live in community. You know, I went to that priest that used to give a lot of workshops on interviewing candidates. Ray Carey. And he said, you know, what you look for is not someone knows how to pray. You can teach them that. You look for someone who knows how to get along with people and live in community and able to roll with things, you know. Basic human qualities, and friendships could be one of them, you know.
A question, something I've run across. I became familiar with spiritual direction, and as I studied that more, I came across a concept of a group spiritual direction. And I'm wondering if that has a space to be employed within a monastic community where you attune the ear of your heart in a group setting and not just on a one-on-one, because that might foster this type of sharing of stories in the contemporary moment. I think that might be a benefit.
Yes, thank you for that observation. We've never done it with people in formation, but I actually didn't do it, but we had a demonstration of it, and our novice directors did it. I forget who was it. Was it one of these psychologists who wrote Will and Grace or something like that? Yeah, Gerald May, yeah. Did he have something like that? And the novice directors used it. And what they would do, they would bring a case or something, someone they're dealing with in their own novitiate, and they would bring it to the group. And they had a program of how they did it. They demonstrated it to the abbots one time because the abbots were worried you were getting into psychology too much. And so they demonstrated that was exactly what he's talking about. And I think it can be very helpful. But I don't know if that would work with, say, novices or people in formation. Exactly. It'd be interesting. Maybe later, after solemn profession, if people did that. Yes. Oh, is that right? Do you remember the name of it? Yeah, group spiritual direction. There you go. That's a clever name. So. Well, let's see, we have Mass at 5, do we? Okay. Thank you very much. See you tomorrow morning.